Let the record show that the House Transportation meeting started at 2 minutes after 1, and the following House members were present: Representative Feige, Representative Isaacson, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Wilson. And I'd like to remind everyone to shut off their phones or at least put them on airplane mode. And recognize the staff today. Over on my right is Nancy Hemingway, who is our House Recording Secretary. And Alex on our left is our LIO monitor. And my committee aide is Becky Rooney. And today we're going to have a hearing on two bills, House Bill 371, followed by 378, the CDL requirements. And so will DOT please come forward? And we have a couple written comments that we'd like to have dealt with, and that we wanted to get some answers to. And then, in addition, we had quite a discussion on the transfer of materials from sites from DNR to DOT and exactly what that means. So if you would come forward and start your testimony and state your names for the record.
I'm Kim Rice with the Department of Transportation, Deputy Commissioner.
Sean Lynch with Department of Law.
John Bennett, Northern Region DOT Right-of-Way Chief.
Okay. So we've got all three, and there was a lot of questions last week, so do you want to go ahead and you had some answers to some of those. Do you want to go ahead and do those first? Or
through the chair. I'd like to just back up again and just kind of summarize the bill. There's some parts to this that we haven't gotten to, and then we'll get into those questions.
All right, that'd be fine.
Okay. So first of all, I just kind of want to remind the committee, as we got into a lot of detail on and in some cases things that aren't in the bill. And so first, I just want to remind the committee that the purpose of this bill, and we have worked very closely with DNR for months to try to work through issues, and as testimony has come forward, we have done some refining with the bill. But the purpose of it is to clarify, streamline, and remove duplicate processes. Both DOT and DNR have duplicate authorities, DOT over transportation facilities, DNR under vacant, unappropriated lands, and then they also have resource authority, which we don't have. So we can do many of the same things that they can under our legislation. And so what has happened over time is we go through processes and do things in our agency, and then we have to go to them. And because they're not aware of what we're doing, or because there is duplicate, there's interpretation of duplication in law, they do the same things over again. And those are the redundancies that we're trying to clarify. So, and part of that's for streamlining project delivery. And then part of it is for the public on disposals. There's a section in this bill for disposals. With lands that some of our right-of-ways are over, once we are willing to give up a small remnant that's not good for us, or we've moved the road away from someone, the property owner has to come to both DOT and DNR. And for DNR, that's a very small piece of land in comparison to all the other things that they manage. And so property owners get lost in that process, and they're hurt by that. So that's it's our DOT's neighbors that we're trying to resolve some of the issues for. And thirdly, we're just trying to resolve some bureaucracies for how we manage related to transportation-related material sites. We really don't want to manage all the material sites. DNR will still have the ability to give to the public material out of these pits and manage them all the same way. They will just consult with us on the ones that we use for transportation. That's kind of the overview intention of the bill. So I think I've pretty much covered it. So what we want to do now is I will go over a little bit about the acquisition process and what this bill does in terms of streamlining the public process, not getting rid of it, but just streamlining it a little bit to shorten the project delivery. And John will discuss with you a little bit about the improvement on the land disposals and how to help neighboring properties. And then Sean will explain more about the material sites. And we put that last because it seemed like that was where most of the questions lied. So we'd leave most time for that. So the public process on project delivery. We've seen some statements and questions from properties. Oh, I'm looking for my... I got it. Okay. So you all have a copy of this, I think, in your packets, this little flow chart. And I think there's two things. We've seen a lot of public comment that has said things like DOT is project-centric, DNR is land-centric. That's true. We are project-centric, and they are land-centric, but our projects are on their land, and they build access to the land. And the other part of it is, in managing the lands, often when we're working projects, DNR is more focused on their on what they're doing, and often less aware of what we've gone through to get a project delivered. So this chart does not include anything about how a project got created or where the community decided they needed it. It's just that it starts with project delivery. And where the little orange circles or clouds are is every time that we touch the public formally. There's an informal process that goes all the time, on all the time during projects. So it starts out when you do the STIP nomination. All projects that DOT works on, whether they're state or federally funded, go through the STIP. So we will have different categories of funding, but they will all show up on our STIP. And that has a fairly extensive public process that's required. Once that's finaled, a project gets started in our preliminary environmental and design process. Most of those projects are federally funded. So NEPA is mandated for federally funded projects. For state-funded projects, while we don't mandate NEPA, there is a way that we hit something federal that requires a NEPA process every single time. So, for example, on the Elmore Road in Anchorage, it was totally state-funded. It was a $40 million project. We built 1,000 feet of bridge mostly for mitigation over federally controlled core permit facilities. We did a NEPA document in parallel with our design process. So I can honestly tell you I have never seen a project without a NEPA process involved. And that NEPA ranges from a checklist to a full-blown EIS, and it has to do what kind of input we get from all of the funding, all of the agencies that we contact. So while you're going through a NEPA process, we are doing, as engineers doing the project, we analyze alternatives that will physically meet the purpose and need. So we do some engineering, you know, figure out where the material sources might be, look for the cheapest ways, which, of course, avoiding bridges is inexpensive, more expensive. But we're also under the federal side and state regulatory side. We talk to the wildlife agencies. We talk to Fish and Game. They have a Title 16 permit. We talk to the Corps because there's wetland permits, and we have to do avoidance. That's their first step. That list on the bottom right-hand corner of that chart is all the agencies, not all of them, but most of the agencies we talk to. During that time, we often do send something to Mining, Land, and Water. We may talk to parks. We talk to all the agencies. Those who are interested or concerned, they rise to the top. And, of course, NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are interested in that kind of thing come to us. So it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly what kind of public process, and it depends on, again, if we're just repaving the road, we do a checklist. If we're going to do an alternative analysis with four, you know, the spaghetti map with four alternatives, it's going to be very, very extensive. And that goes on for years in some cases. When we finally get through that and get a ROD, we've done all of this public process, we go to final design. And that's in a federal highways project. In a state-funded project, we may be doing the design in parallel with the process, but we're doing that. During that time, that's when we start, because we're doing final design, that's when we start doing the permitting. again, the federal agencies can use each other's documents for making decisions. That's the intention. For instance, Federal Highways in agreement with the Corps, the Corps uses the Federal Highways document, so they don't have to recreate that document. But that documentation can be, you know, 6 inches thick, and that's the kind of public outreach that has or will not occur. So they look at that, they do a public notice period, that stuff, that goes on. And it goes, there's several, you know, there's historic properties, there's archaeology, there, the list is long, I'm sure you're all familiar with it. So all of those things occur, and it's a finally we get to the end, close to the end, and we go back, and the communities are involved because they're noticed as a part of all this process during the public process. At the end, we still have to go back one more time and get a local government concurrence. That's a separate statute. So we get local government concurrence, and there's always debates about that, but that occurs. And then, so we get all of our certifications. That's when we start buying right-of-way. We start mapping the right-of-way. And that's the point where we go to Division of Mining, Land, and Water and tell them that we've chosen their land because we've been pushed that because of parks, because of refuges, because of other things. This is the piece that we need from them. You know, because of their statutes and what they do, they start that process over, and they do an analysis again as to what. And sometimes, because of their backlog, it holds up our projects. And so we have a choice then. Do we go ahead and certify a project and just start construction and wait for them to catch up on the paperwork, which is really out of line, but sometimes we're pressured? Or do we wait for them for a couple of years or a year or whatever it takes for them to go through their analysis? But we've gone through this extensive analysis, and their analysis is somewhat duplicative. So what we're trying to do, that's one of the purposes of this bill, is to make it so that they can honor our process and our decision-making as to why they ended up there, and they can just go ahead and give us a transfer. And so the language is very short, and it sounds like a land grab, but all we're asking is that for one state agency to be allowed to use the other state agency's process to move that land over without having to do it, that whole public process again. I think I explained that. So next would be... Oh, do you want to take questions, or do you want to wait till we get through the end of our whole discussion? Let the record show that Representative Lynn has joined us, and I don't see any... Oh, Representative Gaddis.
The other man.
Oh, you don't have a question?
Oh, but Representative Gaddis has joined us. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. I thought maybe I
felt... Yeah, my bad.
Okay, go ahead, because we don't have any questions up to this point. That really clarified it. I think it did. All right.
Thank you. For the record, again, I'm John Bennett with DOT Right-of-Way, and I'm going to speak to the disposal provisions in the bill. And what we've done here is we've tried to adopt uniform language across all three of our authorities for aviation, highways, and public facilities, so they all read exactly the same and cause less confusion and interpretive errors. But we're really also trying to solve a couple of fairly significant problems in the existing language. And one of it, as we've already discussed, is this overlapping authorities between DNR and DOT that sometimes results in an unsolvable problem. And I believe in your packets, we've already discussed in the other meetings, a situation at Eureka Lodge on the Glen Highway where DOT holds a highway easement and DNR owns the underlying fee estate. So when we've identified the problem, which is adjoining property owner has encroached in the right-of-way with these sewage lagoons, and we've acknowledged that we could actually dispose of that width and not impact the highway facility, therefore solving this property owner's problem. But if we vacate the easement, which is all DOT has authority to do right now under the current statutes, all that does is pass the problem on to DNR, and they were unable to resolve it with a preference right sale. So no solution was available under the current statutory language, and the property owner is basically left out in the cold. this language in this proposed bill would solve that problem by virtue of the fact that it will be now recognized that DOT is vested with the fee title for the surface estate in all these transportation facilities that exist. And also with this uniform language, we would then be able to dispose of the fee title interest to this property owner without having to involve DNR. And we would protect the state's interest in that by ensuring that the same types of reservations, say for the mineral estate, are reserved as would occur in a DNR disposal. So that's one of the items we're going to try to address and solve with this legislation. The other issue that we have is a situation in AS35, the disposal language in the AS35 disposal, that is requiring that DOT dispose of any excess land to the person that we originally acquired the land from, or their heirs and assigns, their successors in interest, so to speak. And you'd say, well, how can this be a bad thing? Well, the bad thing could be if we acquired a property, the entire property, there is no remainder, and then at a later date we've determined this property to be excess to our needs, that person very likely, and in the cases that we've been working on, is gone. It's no longer in the area. So do they even have any interest in obtaining title to that property again? We don't know. We can't find them. But there is a party who does want the land, who would really benefit from having that land and is willing to pay the state fair market value for it. We can't do it under the current language, and this bill would solve that problem. Another scenario, if you looked at that same language and say that in our original project we did not acquire the entire property, but we only acquired a very, you know, thin strip just for the widening of a road or something like that. What would occur here is there is a remainder of the property that from the original owner that we purchased it from. Okay? And so if we are going to go ahead and our road moves away so that that strip now becomes excess, it makes sense that it would go back to that original owner. Okay, and we would address that in our analysis because to do anything else would landlock that person. So we're going to give it back to that owner in that case. But let's go back to the situation where we took a total parcel again. Let's say that the entire parcel was not access to our needs, but only a small strip was. And so when we went back to vacate that property, that original owner, according to AS35, would have the right to acquire that strip of property, not the adjoining owner. And that could have the effect of landlocking that property. So we want to make sure that basically in that situation, if that original owner says, well, I know it's only a 20-foot strip of land you're willing to dispose of, but I want it anyway, we would just have to tell them, I'm sorry, we're not going to sell it to anyone because we cannot landlock that adjoining owner. So this current language, or the proposed language in this bill, will solve those problems and make our disposal process much more efficient.
Questions? Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, John, just for the record, are you talking then about sections primarily 4, possibly 5 in that regard? If so, it's only talking about DNR, and yet I can see that you're intending it as a global application.
The sections that we're talking about revising here are sections 2, 4, and 10. Those are the sections that address specifically the disposal language for airports, highways, and public facilities. And while they only address the language in the DOT current statutes, in addition, sections 1, 6, and 9 that vest fee title for these existing facilities into DOT will now allow DOT to dispose of the excess lands by ourselves without having to involve DNR.
Okay, now, so sections 2, 4, and 10 are for just DOT.
Yeah, they're purely DOT's land disposal.
With right-of-ways?
For rights-of-way, yes, for airports, highways, and public.
And then what were the other sections?
The other sections, 1, 6, and 9, those are the ones that are clarifying the overlapping authorities that DNR and DOT have on airport, highway, and public, existing airport, highway, and public facility properties. So say, for example, in the Glen Highway, where we only have an easement interest currently, sections 1, 6, and 9 would basically vest fee title into DOT so that we could manage the disposal by ourselves.
And the main reason for this is because they're so small, the parcels are so small, and DNR has got tons of land and a lot of other things that are really more important to them. And so these don't always get taken care of. I mean, I guess they probably have to do it in order, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, it just takes several years sometimes to get this done. And if it goes to you, then you can deal with it, and it can be done at a much quicker and, I would imagine, cheaper in the long run if you don't have to wait as long.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that assessment. It will happen quicker because we're focusing on one agency's process, and it will speed up some of the process, but there are some of the processes, or there are some of the disposals that we've talked about, like the Eureka Lodge, that we've just hit a roadblock. We cannot accomplish it under the current language.
Because you would like to do it, but you can't, and they aren't even they can't do it with the way the language is for them.
That is absolutely correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from any member of the committee? Okay. All right, that really helps me a lot, because I can that tells me what the sections are really zeroing in on.
And Sean Lynch with Department of Law, and I am going to try to quickly cover the Section 13, and this is the DOT's material sales contract exemption. Section 13 is an amendment to DNR's Alaska Lands Act. Currently, the Section 3805030 are the various exemptions to DNR's rules to the Alaska Lands Act. And so, say, the railroad's exempted, the University of Alaska, DOT has quite a long exemption, Section B. This creates a new subsection D that would exempt the material sales contracting requirements for DOT's use of its pits. And so, I just wanted to explain real quick just these material sites and what we're talking about. When DOT develops a road, like everyone's seen road construction, where you've got cut and fill construction, you cut from the high points, you fill the low points. In the engineering, they try to balance that as well as possible, but for various reasons, sometimes you end up with a deficit in your fill. For that deficit, you open a material site. That's where you're grabbing your extra fill from. When the road project's done, that material site now has the overburden, the ground and trees are removed, and you got a rock face. And so that site is available for later extraction of gravel. And that's the material sites we're talking about. Under DNR's authorities, under the Alaska Lands Act, DNR can sell materials from state-owned material sites, and that's basically their authority. They may sell materials. When DOT, because DOT's road and airport sites are state-owned material sites, DOT, this is the overlapping of those authorities, DOT is under, that rule applies to DOT sites. So when DOT goes to enter into its material sites, it must go to DNR and get a material sales contract. So this Section 13, what it does is it relieves DOT of that responsibility. Or it relieves DNR. It's actually in their statute. It relieves DNR of the responsibility of having to enter these contracts with DOT.
Now, I have a question quickly.
Okay.
So if I'm hearing you right, DOT, these pits were DOTs to begin with.
That is correct. The transportation, the highway, and the airport pits were opened by DOT. And
right.
In fact, DOT carries the environmental permits.
Okay.
When there are third-party material sales, it is DNR comes to DOT and notifies them. We have an intended sale, and DOT gives the intended permittee the contract or the environmental conditions they have to follow to use DOT's pits. But yes, I will make clarification that not all pits. If there is a private development, say a subdivision development, and someone opens a private developer opens a DNR site, takes as much materials as they need, they're done with their development. When they leave that pit, their authorization is through. DNR now has another pit. So
okay.
So the majority, and I want to say vast majority, but surely the majority of these pits and the ones that are on DOT's facilities are DOT pits.
Okay. Got it. All right. Continue.
Okay. So there are two main concerns that have been raised. And one is that Section 13 is going to give DOT carte blanche authority to go into any state-owned pit. So there are two reasons that this isn't the case. Well, for one, this is an amendment to the Alaska Lands Act. So this is an instruction to DNR when DOT goes into DOT is exempt from the contracting requirements. The Alaska Lands Act sections 550 through 565. There is a list of pits that are open for material sales contracting. This exemption is only talking about that defined list of pits.
Okay.
It's a little over 500 pits in the state of Alaska. So it's not giving DOT, this is not an amendment to DOT statute, it's not giving DOT any additional authority to go anywhere. It's a DNR exemption that they don't have to process material sales contracts for DOT's use of these pits.
So it's just eliminating DNR's part in it, because now DOT will be able to take care of it. But they went through DNR. They were still doing it, but they went through DNR to do it.
Exactly right. And DOT currently has the authority over its rights-of-ways and facilities, and DOT is still acting under its existing authorities. It just cuts off that one step where we have overlapping authorities. It just says you don't need a DNR authorization to enter into and use.
Okay, again, saving time and possibly money. And Representative Tompkins, did you snap your fingers?
Yeah, sorry. It's so getting your attention.
How you doing?
Clarifying question. So Section 13 applies only to the 500 pits already in statute associated with the Alaska Lands Act?
That's right. In fact, Section 13, the opening phrase,
notwithstanding the provisions.
Yes, and it's the designated pits are the pits in the DNR issues contracts under 550 through 565. And this was the second. There was another comment that DOT would be competing with. The example was the North Slope users, and for one, aside from the Dalton Highway, DOT doesn't have any jurisdiction. It doesn't have any reason or any authority to go to North Slope development areas to get materials. And those are single purpose. Those are the developer's single purpose pits. They're not, those pits aren't open for third party sales. So any North Slope pit, any pit that's open for a specific DNR project is not one of the pits that DNR does third-party sales. So this is really, this is only, it relieves DNR of the duty to issue the third-party sales under its existing third-party sales contract.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm reading Dick Milius's letter, and in his first point relating to Section 13, he says, quote, if I may, many gravel pits on state land are developed by and the gravel sold to private developers, et cetera. Is that statement inaccurate then? If these 500 pits were all our DNR pits originally as provided in statute?
No, and actually, and that's what I was, through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, the DNR is authorized to sell materials from DOT pits. And so there is both DOT use coming from these pits, and there's also third-party sales in these pits. These are shared use permits. DOT and DNR both coordinate on these sales, so that hasn't been a problem. It still won't be a problem. There wasn't that comment, but there was another about depletion of the pits. So far, to my knowledge, that hasn't been a problem. This bill wouldn't change the quantity of materials, obviously. But if there were, it hasn't been a problem yet. DNR is being able to waive the contracting requirements for DOT does not in any way cut off the third-party use of those pits.
Follow-up.
So Section 13 doesn't restrict DOT at all to the use of those pits. So DOT can get whatever materials, whatever gravel it needs out of these pits, because DNR is no longer involved in managing them. Simplifies the process, makes it more efficient. Am I correct so far?
That's correct. It becomes a DOT, by DOT's needs, DOT enters its pits and...
So if DNR is out of the equation, out of the picture, but there's already a pre-existing private sale or vendor associated with those pits, what protects that private vendor or sale?
That's the coordination that happens now and will continue to happen between the agencies. So there's DNR and DOT coordinate together, because that third-party sale, the person is going to have environmental conditions. They can't change the water flow in the pit because of the Clean Water Act, and they can't get in DOT's way. A lot of times the condition is you stay on this part of the pit and we'll stay on this part of the pit, just so they're not bumping into each other. That would continue to happen. And yeah, so really, if there's a valid existing right or a future right, you know, a contract for next summer or the summer after, it's that same program that both the public and DOT are using the pits.
You know what? DNR is here, and when Menifee can come up and just make a couple statements, I think he'll be able to clarify this a little bit easier. So let's see if we can.
I am Wynn Menifee, Chief Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water for DNR. And what I should explain is on these pits that are being referred to, that are designated sites, material sites, under 3805-550, the current law says that you have to designate a site in order to sell material out of it. And the designation just says to the public, and you go through a public written decision, we are going to sell the material out of this for X number of years, this size, and we'll be doing multiple material sale contracts out of that. At which point, we start issuing material sale contracts, and we don't have to go back out to public notice on all the material sale contracts. They will go to whoever asks for material as long as there's material in the site. A slight correction on what Sean had said about, do we have sole purpose sites? Very few of any of our sites are sole purpose. We sell to multiple individuals, multiple companies out of a site. So even the ones that, like you referred to on the North Slope, we sell to multiple entities out of the same pit. We may have one operator that's the primary operator that's responsible for the permitting, but we sell to multiple entities underneath that. And there is the coordination, just like Sean was saying, is if DOT is the what we call the pit operator, then anybody else that comes into that pit would be, what we'd force them to be, is subservient to the first individual that opened the pit. And the main reason is that if they've got permits that say we're going to comply with stormwater discharge or whatever, mm-hmm. we don't want the next person coming in violating something that they're responsible for. So we do that, whether it's for DOT or whether it's for BP or whoever that opened the pit.
Now, will that continue?
So the way that that we read this is that we have dual management authority on those pits. When he says we'll be out of it, the aspect is we will not be telling DOT they need a contract. Will we still manage those pits and still authorize to other entities? Yes. But we will do it under concurrence of DOT. The way the bill is created is with DOT and top dog authority. And so what it means is if we then decide that we are going to issue another contract to somebody else, we need to first come to DOT and say, is it okay if we do that? Now, that's for any of the sites that they say either that have been transferred over to them or if they're in operating in those sites.
Okay, one question right here. I think the biggest concern is people want to know if the third party comes in and has gotten an agreement, I don't know what to get so much out of there. Can DOT say no, you can't have that?
So, Madam Chair, the answer to that is that according to the provision here, they would have the right in any of our sites to come in and take whatever quantity that they want, regardless of whether there's contracts there. However, I'll let DOT explain this, but as I understand it, they would, if they came in and made a risk analysis and said, we still want that, even though we know that we're going to potentially breach a contract of somebody, they would have to pay them for that amount or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sean could probably go into that more. But the existing contracts, it would not prevent DOT from going in and taking all the material. But they would risk analysis.
Yeah, and they would have to. Make sure. So it wouldn't like break somebody because they were planning on that and that didn't happen. It would be because they would get reimbursed.
And Sean Lynch with Department of Law, and yes, it's Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution that we can't take. It is a private property right if there is a contract for that material, and DOT tries whatever it can to avoid takings. But if it was a necessity, the DOT, this for whatever reason, but let's say it was and there was only one source, DOT needed it, DOT would reimburse the private contractor.
All right, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just for purposes of clarification for members of the committee, Section 13, it basically says DOT is using this for construction or maintenance of essentially a facility that DOT is either constructing or operating. In DNR's experience, what other uses besides transportation uses are these materials sold for, and to what types of entities?
Representative Feige through the chair. The material sites that we have multiple users using it, everything from a homeowner that wants to put material on their driveway to all sorts of constructions in Alaska, you know, whether it's road, building construction, renewable energy, GVA. We have material sites that cover the whole realm of construction projects. And we sell gravel, sand, riprap that's used on habitat projects, boat launches, things like that. We have just hard rock that could be used for even for decorative things, for houses, you know, putting on the walls and things like that. So there's a whole slew of different reasons why people have bought material from State Land.
Any other, do you have any other questions, or, Representative Christ Tompkins?
Not on Section 13.
Okay. Representative Isaacs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have
this look on your face.
I do. I just have this one question that on Section 13 then, just to clarify, up north the question was that, and Sean, I believe you brought it out, the North Star Borough may have a competing claim for this land itself. I guess that's a DNR question, Winifred. So how is this obviating their ability to make a claim or not? I mean, does it remove them from being able? Do we have to put specific language that says, for example, Happy Valley now belongs to the state or what?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, I don't think this is applicable just to 13. This is, you know, in any of the transfers over to DOT. The question I think where you're getting at is if the borough has asked for, let's say, a municipal entitlement on those lands, if DOT under the other sections, which I'd have to get correct here, that where they ask for land, and those are sections 3, 5, and 8. So under 3, 5, and 8, where they ask for land to be transferred over, if the borough has also selected that under a municipal entitlement, what would happen is because DOT is speaking to the need that they need it for, and in this bill puts us subservient to that, the what it means is that the municipal entitlement, which is under our authorities, would be subservient to DOT's needs. If DOT says we need this airport, we need this material site, then we would probably have to go and deny the municipal entitlement, at least at this point in time. Now conceivably, I think Sean gave the example the other day. Let's say, for example, they have a material site and they go in, they use up all the material. At that point, they don't have need of that land anymore. They could say, we'll give it back to DNR if that's the route that they chose to do so, at which point we could give that to a municipality. Usually the municipality is selected for a reason, for revenue generation, one being material sites, so that would be the reason why they were selecting it, likely. And so I guess there is a tension there, a competition for that same piece of land. This bill does put DOT in first place, and DNR would have to adjust our municipal entitlement program to answer that as the municipality selected those lands.
Thank you. Just a follow-up then. As a
follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as intent, DOT is, according to this bill, is only doing it for a public need and necessity anyway. So I take it that anything that DOT uses this land for and has priority for is going to be a public benefit, and therefore the borough or wherever this public benefit is situated is going to benefit.
And Representative Isaacson, through the chair, Sean Lynch with Department of Law, and just using the example of the material sites on Happy Valley and Franklin Bluffs, if DOT, once the DOT receives those sites and develops them as DOT maintenance stations, it would take an extra step
from DNR to designate those sites as available for material sales. Recall that there is a specific list of sites where municipalities and, well, where the public can receive materials. If DNR was to add those sites to their list, make them designated sites, then the municipality could receive materials along with any other third party. They become like the other, but presently, to my knowledge, they're not on the designated site list.
If I could follow up with that through the chair,
state your names.
Wynn Menifee, for the record. The difference of municipal entitlement versus just receiving material through a material sale contract is a different scenario. So municipal entitlements, they are asking for full fee simple of the land. There is the competition in that aspect. What Sean just described is also correct, that if they just need material and the borough needs material, they can come into a material site designation, even where we would transfer the main ownership over to DOT, because we have the joint management authority the way that this bill states it. DNR could still designate a site per concurrence with DOT. We could still sell material to the borough with concurrence with DOT. If they say we don't need it all, sure, you go ahead and sell this much out of it. We could sell to the borough. So they would be like any other entity, and they could get a material sale contract from us. And they have in the past. So there's two different things. There's municipal entitlement, and that's a program within itself, and then there's the material sale contracts. So we're dealing with the boroughs in two different facets there.
Right. Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Isaacson.
So just to make really clear, to put it on the record, that if DOT is having a priority, it's because you are providing a public benefit that then benefits the borough, a road, an airport, et cetera. These things aren't excluding a borough entitlement in that sense. Borough is trying to make money, but they shouldn't be making the money necessarily at the expense of everyone else around the state, who then would have to pay for that benefit that really affects any borough, wherever the borough is, with the land, a road or a port or a airport. Did I mention road, airport, port, whatever? I mean, this, and I just want to make really clear, that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're not just talking about the state of Alaska, DOT, grabbing land for some future purpose. You're using it for a specific purpose, as Kim, you outlined in your opening statement. And so we're not precluding any other subdivision of the state from making revenue. We're just saying that this is a priority that benefits the borough, it benefits everybody in Alaska, and therefore that's why this priority is here. Correct?
Representative, through the chair, I believe that that's correct, that is DOT's purpose and intent, is to do it for public benefit. I cannot speak to whether the boroughs feel that that's right to put them in top position. I don't know that.
Right.
But,
okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Well, we actually haven't had any comments from boroughs, and they have people that look at this and watch this kind of thing, and no one has complained. So, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thanks. This is in the same vein, I guess, a question for Wynn and Sean. Again, I'm just working my way through the concerns that Dick outlined in this letter, trying to better understand them and get agency response. And the second point that he outlines is basically putting DOT in top dog position for DNR land. And in Dick's letter, he says DOT use may also not be the most economically valuable use of the land, and DNR will therefore not have the ability to deny a DOT request even if there is a higher or better use of the land, such as land needed by a school district or for a public school. And I guess my question for you, Wynn, is are there examples that pop to mind that might validate that scenario or hypothetical, or is that purely a theoretical concern?
Representative Christ-Tompkins, through the chair, what happens when we make decisions on whether to designate a site to sell materials? The standard that we will go through is an best interest decision, what's in the best interest of the state. what this does is that removes that decision process from us. And so you may get a situation that will have to be resolved in a different fashion. And so, for instance, I'll just give an example. Let's say the pipeline is going down through an area, and they've got a demand for the material, the same material the DOT has a demand for. Normally, in our process, we would go and we would wrestle those two interests, and we would see, can we accommodate both? Can we make some tweaks on one or the other to make it happen for both? Or if we can't, then we have to sometimes say one's more important than the other. So that is a decision process that we normally would go through. What this bill, the way it sets up, is if DOT asked for that material site, we would not do that decision. Now, obviously, DOT has to evaluate what's their benefit through their public process. And if there was some higher, better interest that somebody brought to the governor's attention or something like that, then I'm sure they would be speaking to DOT and saying, yeah, maybe that's not a good idea. So, but there would be a different type of process. It wouldn't be the type of process that DNR normally does.
And believe me, I've got a feeling if it was whether the pipeline or something else, legislators would be notified, and they probably would be making some comments also. So, mm-hmm. I mean, either way, we would see there's ways that we can always intervene. And, anyway, that's, it just depends there again. If it would be some, DOT would be talked to, and they probably would change their mind or something.
Follow-up
Representative Price Tompkins.
And this is for Wynn, but are there any specific examples, for instance, where DOT requested an easement or requested a right-of-way that DNR found was not in the highest and best use of that particular land that you're aware of in the past?
Representative, through the chair, I'm pausing because I'm trying to think if there is any. I can't remember of anyone that we've denied that they've asked. The only thing I can think of is one that had a potential corridor that was put there as a potential future need, at which point over the period of time, land was conveyed to municipalities and this and that, and the purpose of the corridor basically was defeated by how segmented that corridor got, and then the remainders that were still possible to give over to DOT at some point in time didn't really make sense anymore. And we worked with DOT and explained that and showed that, at which point we vacated those or closed those case files on conveying over those corridors because they didn't make sense anymore. That's the only one I can think of to my recollection.
Go ahead.
For the record, John Bennett and Representative Christ Tompkins through the chair. In my almost 30 years as right-of-way chief Northern Region, I also cannot recall a situation where an application to DNR for a right-of-way has been denied. I mean, the reality is the Department of Transportation provides public infrastructure for transportation in the state, and all the competing interests that we've discussed so far, whether it be a school or a pipeline, they depend and rely upon the ability of the Department of Transportation to provide that infrastructure so they can access their sites. So in that sense, it kind of makes more sense that it is a higher priority, or it is a very important priority that has to be considered before you can get to these other types of projects.
This is Wynn. As a follow-up to the chair on that, is just as I was thinking, there are certain times that we've come back to DOT and said, because of our decision process, there's other interests that we have to accommodate. And DOT has either reconditioned their application to adjust to those other needs, or they've withdrawn their application. So there have been instances of that where we've said, okay, forestry for this purpose, fish and game for this purpose, this school for that purpose needs it, and we brought those concerns to the forefront in the adjudication, but rather than stamping it denied, we bring that back to DOT, as we do with most applicants, and say, here's the concerns. Is there a way we can work around this? And they may adjust the size of what they've asked for. They may put in conditions that allow that. So our desire is always to try to find a way to authorize that, and so we work diligently to do that. That's why I think we've never gotten to a denial. If we just based it on an application that could never change, maybe we could have gotten to a denial, but we always work toward amending, modifying, or whatever to adjust to the circumstance.
Okay.
Kim Rice, through the chair. I did want to add one thing, and that is when I was discussing the public process, and I said we're not good about contacting Division of Mine, Land, and Water and making sure there aren't applicants because we wouldn't know if someone had applied for something. That is something that we intend to add back and emphasize in our process and add them as an agency that we'll contact so that we will know whether or not they've got applications and what concerns they may have earlier in the time frame. That's our intent.
I'm glad you mentioned that and that we have that on the record because that's important. And I think that it eases my mind in that instance. And so I hope it does. Does anyone else have any questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Imagine that, government agencies working together. It's a beautiful thing. Could we talk about Section 16 of the bill? This is where we're dealing with reciprocal easements or granting of reciprocal easement rights. Could you just go into the kind of the history and the background and why we need to do that?
Representative Feige, through the chair, Sean Lynch with Department of Law. And I just want to make sure that we're all looking at the same. This is the last CS or the current bill, which is
Version C.
Just because that provision has been modified for clarity.
Maybe I have it in here somewhere.
And you can see this.
Okay.
This is the new language.
I do. Okay. And I'll just explain really quickly what the modification was, is the word grant, well, in fact, the first sentence was removed, and the second sentence rewritten to incorporate the reciprocal exchange. And so what this provision is doing is we have an agreed-upon exchange, but all of the easements have not transferred from the state government to the federal government. And in fact, we are still waiting for one easement to go from the federal government to state government. And so what that first sentence had done is it mimicked the federal statute. And so the easements are hereby granted. Or the easements, I think the language said, are granted. We just removed that to clarify that DNR was not being asked to actually take any action. What the provision does, it was meant to do and clearly does now, is authorize DNR to extend the term of the easements beyond the 55-year their regulatory limitation and upon a best interest finding of the commissioner of DNR.
Okay.
Any questions? Sure. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Again, working my way down through Dick's letter. This is a how-to guide for the bill. I've released for some questions. So in his letter, Mr. Milius points out that 66 sites for these easements have been approved and 67 have not, and that he says it's his understanding that many of the remaining sites do not have existing facilities, and some are also important public access sites. What are the 67 remaining sites that have not yet been approved?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, they are all submerged land sites, and they are all for the benefit of the U.S. Forest Service. of that set, there are log transfer facilities, cabins, trail access points. What the modification that we made to Section 16 was actually to address Mr. Milius's concerns that he was afraid that the verb grant actually directed DNR to make a decision on them, and we have modified that language to make absolutely clear that's not what we're asking for. It's to give DNR authorization.
And he mentioned in his letter that the committee substitute took care of that.
Yes, he did. Okay. He did issue a follow-up letter.
Okay. What are the wishes of the committee?
Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative Price-Tompkins.
Thank you. This double backs to the previous questions about DOT sort of getting first pick, being the top dog when it comes to state land. And when we're talking about higher and best use of the state land, Mr. Menefee, you mentioned that sometimes if there are other uses or parties identified for land that DOT wants, you work with DOT to figure out how to recondition the request or make it so that everyone can win, basically, it sounds like. So the whole purpose of this bill, as I understand it, is to streamline permitting, make things more efficient, save time. And when we're talking about time getting burned with this interagency working relationship, is that time mostly is the paperwork mostly the sort of de rigueur easements that are granted by DNR, or are the delays in projects owed to having to actively work with DNR, for instance, to recondition a permit if they're higher and best uses? I mean, how much time are we talking in each scenario? Like if DOT wants land, no other parties are identified that are interested in that land, how much time does that take versus an instance where DOT wants some land and there are other parties and you have to work with DNR to recondition the request or whatever it might be? How much time can that scenario take?
Through the chair, Representative Price Tompkins. This is John Bennett with DOT. The interest that we request of DNR vary in level from a right-of-way permit that we commonly use for a highway right-of-way to an interagency land management assignment, which is a stronger interest that we would use for an airport. And then, of course, we've discussed the material site, so that they're all a little bit different, and they all have different levels of complexities, and there is really no specific time frame that I can say that they take. It also goes to what's on DNR's desk at the time that we submit an application. They have an awful lot of work to deal with also. We hope to capture all the concerns of the public in the process that Deputy Commissioner Rice outlined that we're going through and are actually going to improve upon, so that we don't end up in a situation where we have analyzed, we have mitigated and avoided all the impacts we possibly can for a specific project, and possibly even commenced with the acquisition of right-of-way to find that here's a DNR parcel we apply for, and should the day ever come that they reach a conclusion that maybe a campground would be better suited for that parcel, you can see the dilemma that would place the department. We'd end up having to either, one, appeal, which we've never had to do yet. We might have to go back and reinitiate the entire process to look for an alternative site. Or there may be some other options, we believe that all the interests of the public will be protected under the process that we bring to the table in our project development, and nothing will be lost by streamlining this process as the bill presents.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. And Representative Feige.
Madam Chair, I move CS for HB 371-28-LS-1545/Charlie from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
And hearing no objections, so moved. And we'll have a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back in session now, and we now have House Bill 378, driver's licensing. I just want everybody to know I do not plan to on passing this bill out today, but I would like Becky and Amy, if you want to come up, to come forward and state your names and affiliation for the record, and then we'll let you kind of go into a little bit, and then we'll proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Becky Rooney, staff to Representative Peggy Wilson. HB 378 adds additional safety-related improvements to the commercial permitting requirements to comply with federal mandates. They include raising the minimum age to obtain a commercial driver's license learner's permit from 17 to 18 years of age. It also limits the period of that CDL learner's permit validity time from it is 180 days with the opportunity to it was two years. Now it's going to be 180 days with the opportunity to renew for another additional 180 days. HB 378 will make the roads a safer place for all Alaskans by allowing the DMV to refuse to register or revoke a registration for a motor carrier or commercial vehicle that does not meet federal safety requirements. Additionally, a CDL permit will be disqualified in the same manner as a license if the driver is operating while non-compliant with federal safety regulations or out of service, or they obtain a conviction for manslaughter or negligent homicide resulting from driving a motor vehicle or for the commission of a felony using a motor vehicle. Texting while driving will also be a serious traffic violation by which the CDL operators could lose their license or permit for a period of time. If this bill is not passed, or parts of this bill are not passed, Alaska will be out of compliance with federal regulations. And non-compliance could result in the federal government decertifying Alaska's CDL program. The decertification could jeopardize Alaska's federal highway funding. And DOT reports that based on the 2014 apportionments, this could mean a loss of up to $34 million in federal dollars. There is, in addition to the these permitting and licensing requirements, there is additional language to clarify that the registration fees charged for vehicles over 10,000 pounds that are used for personal use and in an individual's name is the same as the commercial vehicles rates that are the same weight. We are not changing any of the current fee schedules. We are just clarifying that all vehicles over 10,000 pounds will pay commercial fees for registration. So, Madam Chair, with your permission, we would like to have the Director of the DMV, Amy, walk through the sectional of HB 378 and then answer any questions the members may have.
Okay. Representative Gaddis?
I'm going to hold back. Well, no, I'm not. Thank you. And I guess, your original statement, great. I think there was one part that really caught me, and it really had to do with texting. It was the could be revoked versus, in my opinion, should. I guess I look at folks with a CDL as a step higher than a regular driver's license, and I expect that people that are driving commercially should not be texting, and I would think that the punishment for texting or being a commercial driver really must be at a higher level. And I, so I took I took exception to the verbiage that said could be revoked. In my opinion, should be revoked. And I just wanted to put that statement on the record because I do think that commercial drivers are held at a higher level.
Amy, do you want to make a comment about that?
For the record, Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Personally, I concur with you. I do. Thank you, Becky. That was a great introduction of the bill. Thank you to the committee for sponsoring this legislation. It is important to the DMV to keep our commercial driver's licensing in compliance. And I would be happy to go through the sectional. It's in your packet, but I'm glad to do so. Section 1 gives the ability of the DMV to refuse to register a vehicle if the vehicle owner has failed to comply with reporting federal reporting requirements. And currently, we don't have the authority to refuse to register a vehicle if it's been placed out of service. And we were found out of compliance in this area by the Federal Motor Carrier Association, Safety Administration, that is. Section 2 is amended to allow the DMV to suspend or revoke a registration of a vehicle if the carrier or the vehicle has been placed out of service by the feds as well. Section 3 is amended to clarify that this is the part that's not a compliance area. This is related to the fees. It clarifies that the free vehicle registration for residents 65 and older or are disabled applies only to those vehicles that are under 10,000 pounds. And that's already in statute. It was just a way for them to reconfigure these areas to achieve what we needed to achieve. Section 4 is repealed and reenacted to modify the section above to clarify the fees for non-commercial vehicles that weigh less than 10,000 pounds. The fees do not change, and the section is reconfigured for clarity. Section 5 establishes that the free fees for vehicle, except for passenger, low-speed trucks, vans, or trailers, are based on the weight of the vehicle. So as Becky said, the fees for those vehicles will now be comparable to what is in current statute that looks like commercial fees. So all of these fees will now be based on the weight of the vehicle if they're over 10,000 pounds. And the reason that that change was necessary is because of a couple of complaints that we received from the Ombudsman's Office for people that had, one guy had a Mack truck. It was over 10,000 pounds. He felt that because it was in his name, personal name, and not in his company name, he should not have to pay commercial fees, but just the $100 fee. But the statute says those vehicles under 10,000 pounds are $100. And then commercial fees for that particular weighted vehicle is $268. So that's the real reason for this change, is to make it clear that those weighted vehicles will have the same fee structure as what was considered commercial.
Okay, Representative Gaddis.
And based on the commercial, does the farm exemption still apply?
Through the chair.
Not that it's always about me, but I just want to be put on record. At this point, it does, and I'm just wondering if this makes a change. And we own a farm, so I just know that there's a farm exemption that typically has. Does this make that change?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, there's no change to the farm vehicles whatsoever.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
And maybe I should wait till we're done, but it goes to this 10,000 pound. I'll let you continue, because once I get started, I don't know where I'm.
You know, I would imagine, too, just watching them go down the road, the people that want to check on things don't know whether that truck is owned by an individual or by a company. And just by looking, and because of the weight, and this would make it easier for them, too, I would imagine.
Madam Chair, we went through this last year, and the legislature passed a provision that exempted vehicles up to 14.5, and that was signed by the governor, and this undoes all that.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, that bill related to the commercial motor vehicle enforcement, the weight of a vehicle that would be enforced. These are strictly the DMV fees. That's why DMV wasn't involved in that legislation. This speaks only to our fees, not anything to do with enforcement.
Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Isaacson.
And I appreciate what you're saying, Amy, but it's going to be the confusion of the enforcement officer. Well, you know, you're being charged this registration fee, so therefore you must be a commercial vehicle. Having supervised enforcement officers, I want to make sure that there is as the minimum ambiguity as possible. And when we have inconsistencies in a registration form and then in the law, what's going to be in front of the officer is going to be something that triggers their response more than what's in the law, because they'll have to, that'll be more obscure. And so I was wondering why we would be doing
this. Well, you know, we just happen to have, if you don't mind, Amy, Daniel Smith is online, and he's with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and he's the one that is in charge of that. So, Daniel, are you online?
Madam Chair, yes, I am. For the record, Daniel Smith with Commercial Vehicle Enforcement. And commercial vehicle enforcement for regulating intrastate vehicles and interstate vehicles, we go off gross vehicle weight rating or gross combination weight rating. So Ms. Erickson's bill here has to do with the unladen weight of the vehicle, where us in the enforcement committee, we're speaking in terms of the gross vehicle weight rating as set by the manufacturer.
So this is not going to cause any questions of enforcement?
We certainly check for valid registration. However, we do not enforce the type of registration as you guys are looking at it now. We make sure that the vehicle is registered. I do not believe it adds any confusion for our enforcement officers.
Okay, thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Isaacson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In all respect, I don't know how to frame this question. So, after a while down the road, okay, when the law becomes much more clear and the 14.5 is the limit, Mr. Smith, I appreciate how you've worked with my office in the bills in the past, and so I respect what you have to say, don't get me wrong. But if an officer's got someone pulled over, and not necessarily a commercial officer, but let's say it's just a trooper or a beat cop, and they pulled them over and they look at the registration, and the registration is a commercial vehicle. So all of a sudden now the officer who has not been in commercial enforcement is going to have to figure out, is there another violation? Because as a commercial vehicle, wait, you know, he may have some or she may have some knowledge of commercial requirements, and they may say, well, you don't have your gross vehicle weight posted, you know, you don't have your certain equipment affixed permanently. You know, they might know enough to cause a moment of consternation. And so I'm wondering if we're setting it up for someone who is not in your department, but someone who is, you know, enforcing public safety to unnecessarily have question and therefore cause a situation, an unfortunate situation.
Mr. Smith.
Representative Isaacson, through the chair. I believe this section that is speaking only to the fee for the registration would not be confusing for our enforcement personnel or others who may be trained to do the enforcement that we do every day. During the driver interview, we are looking at origin, destination, whether there's a hazardous material, size of the load, weight of the load. So through this driver interview, we are gathering many more facts other than what was just presented. Whether that would be when we ask for the driver qualifications, medical fitness card, and then the registration, proof of insurance. I think those are all elements to that driver interview, and the fact that this registration fee may be changed, I don't know that it adversely affects that interview or would dictate the outcome, would be an error.
So a follow-up to clarify.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. So, and this may be for Amy then. Does the registration that would be shown to the traffic officer or enforcement officer, would that have commercial on it, or is it going to have, you know, I mean, is it going to be a generic one like everyone else, or will it say commercial vehicle?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I believe it looks just like the rest of ours that has a regular passenger vehicle that just says, you know, vehicle registration fees $100, MBRT 70, and the totals. I don't think that it has anything, it says anything about commercial fees, because it just shows what the fee is. It doesn't report why it's this amount.
Okay, I'll follow up later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
One other thing I should mention, Madam Chair, is that this is actually DMV's current policy. When this was enacted in 1978, it was, we've been doing it since 1978. We've been charging commercial fees for vehicles over 10,000 pounds. And this, we were questioned about it by the Ombudsman. This is our attempt to make it clear that what we're doing is, the drafter thought we were fine in the way we were doing it and the way it was stated, but because we've had these complaints, we wanted to make it clearer for the public.
And it definitely is clear to me, I mean, just by looking at it, you know. So, Representative Gaddis, do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Smith. This is Representative Gaddis, and I guess my questions, I was going along with Representative Isaacson, and I fit in a very unique situation from a farming standpoint, and Mr. Smith and I have had conversation before, and the DOT has, and it's such a unique, very small amount of folks that are involved in agriculture, but we do have what some, we try to avoid the way stations is the bottom line, but we have had where we're hauling what we use for fence pipes, and they're really the drillers use up there on the north slope, and we use it for, you know, after they've used them, the fence pipes, and we've gotten that whole commercial agricultural questioning, and it's a real struggle at times, and it doesn't go to these fees at all, but really what it goes to is trying to determine the difference between a commercial carrier and a non-commercial, and that's what triggered my questions with Representative Isaacson. We have certainly learn to carry the rules in our glove boxes and be able to train the folks at the weigh station. I don't expect them to be trained. We're not a huge agricultural state, and we've learned how to do that. And folks out in our farming area, we've just passed in the same regulations, so we use that. And I don't know what exceptions Representative Isaacson might have coming up with, but when there's small exceptions, it's tough to train everybody on those very minute rules. And I do appreciate Mr. Smith helping us out and helping other farmers out in that same commercial versus agriculture in this case. But I just did want to put it on the record that sometimes it's very hard to fill in everybody and everything that we're doing. So I'm just hoping that the law that we passed last year doesn't get affected beyond the fees that we're discussing, because I think that was a great bill that was passed, and I hope that doesn't go backwards. So I guess that's really what I want to state on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Amy, we didn't mean to stop you in the middle, but okay. We got our questions answered.
Thank you. Back to Section 7. This just adds the fee structure into the motor vehicle registration tax chart, which you'll see on page 6 of the bill. Section 8 clarifies that the section applies to non-commercial instruction permits and allows a person to obtain an instructional permit for a certain class of license once 5 years has passed. Currently, DMV cannot issue a license to, or they can't revert a license back to an instructional permit if they've already had that class of license. And this was brought to our attention for one reason, was a woman who was brain injured and had a CDL license. She was unable to drive for several years and didn't have the confidence to go right back in and start driving, but she needed an instructional permit to allow her to practice. And we couldn't just give her an instructional permit because she'd had the license before. So this helps people like that. And it also allows us to issue a license to a person. For example, someone with a CDL license, they can have a certain class of license and get an instructional permit for another type of license so they can practice for a different class of vehicle.
So this Section 8 allows an instructional permit that's non-commercial to be issued if it's less than 5 years.
It allows us to issue an instruction permit, and then they can get a new one if 5 years has passed since they've had it before.
Okay.
And if they've obtained another license.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not real clear on that, so I'm going to ask you to hopefully say it a different way. Because I guess what I'm asking is, if somebody, and we'll use the brain damage or car accident application, and they've had a driver's license since they're 16, and let's say they're 45, what I'm hearing you say is you can go backwards now where you couldn't and say, could I get a instructional driver's license, not a CDL, but driver's license until I feel confident and I can pass the driver's test in order to get my regular driver's license. I'm just not real clear where the 5 years fits in, and I'm struggling with that.
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, right now you cannot get an instruction permit if you've already had the license. And the 5 years is because that's the term of a license, so you haven't had it. So licenses are issued for 5 years, and that's the reason for the 5 years.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Addis.
My brother doesn't watch Gavel to Gavel, but I have a brother, not that one. I have a brother that had a car accident, and it was a huge struggle to get his driver's license after a car accident, so this would have really, really helped him. His older sister then had to reteach him to drive, and it would have been really great to have had that, so I think that's a good thing put in the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Section 9 is added to meet federal compliance. It will require an applicant for a commercial instruction permit to be 18 instead of 17. It modifies the statute for federal compliance by limiting the validity, as Becky said, for an instruction permit to be 180 days with a renewal of 180 days. This is a federal requirement. It was 2 years.
Just a minute, Amy. Representative Feige has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the previous section, the learner's permit, there's language in here that says somebody at least 21 years old has to accompany them. Even though it's a commercial instruction, people say learning how to drive an 18-wheeler, I don't see language that says there has to be an instructor along with them.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, actually your staff brought that to our attention. It's an omission that should be in the bill.
Okay.
Yes. They should have a licensed driver with them.
I'm sure you can figure out how to fix it.
That's one reason why I said we weren't going to move the bill, because there's a couple things that need to be fixed, and we'll bring it up next time with any changes that this committee decides to make, but that's one of them.
Fair enough.
Okay, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on this, Amy, this Section 9, it used to be 2 years, and now it's 180 days.
Mm-hmm.
So someone could conceivably drive in the spring through the early winter and never have driven in snow, but then be given a commercial driver's license. And you preface this by saying this is to enable Alaskans to be more safe on the roads. How's this helping that safety issue?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I guess your concern is that they hadn't driven in inclement weather?
Sure.
I don't know how to resolve that. I mean, they do get to renew it, so they would have it for a full year and would have driven also in the spring and summer and winter.
Madam Chair.
Follow up?
So they may request, but they may also say, gee, I'm ready to take this test. And they could also apply to get a commercial driver's license at that time, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. But if they pass the test, then what's to keep them from driving?
Madam Chair, in response to the question, again, I go back to the idea that this bill is to make Alaska safer. And if we're looking at the number of accidents that we're trying to protect ourselves from, and yet now we're creating a situation where we could create more accidents because we have not been able to verify, perhaps there's not an instructor and perhaps there's also not an inclement weather test, but I can just see havoc coming at the, you know, when we were talking about a 550, a Ford 550, for example, and how dangerous that could be hitting a small car. Now you've got an 18-wheeler or something with someone behind the wheel who is qualified to drive by the 180-day standard, but has never really tested themselves in snow and slick conditions.
But doesn't this, right now, I'm not sure, but right now can't they do it with, they don't have to have an instructional permit, and this is saying, wait, we need to think about it, and we need to have them get an instructional permit?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, the person still has to be a qualified driver. They have to pass the driving test.
As with anybody?
Yes.
I mean, you know, what I'm thinking of, anybody that gets a driver's license, I could practice in the, you know, I mean, we could, if that was the case, we'd say to everybody.
Well, I understand that we've taken this from 17 years of age because of the provisional character, I would estimate. You don't want a CDL and a provisional. Well, even in Alaska, I suppose this would be a question, if I may address it to Amy. 17-year-olds in Alaska have provisional driver's license. If we're reducing the time it takes to get a driver's license to 180 days instead of 2 years, it's conceivable that somebody who has a provisional driver's license on the non-commercial side could have a commercial driver's license, a CDL, and not be 18 years of age. And so on one side they're provisional, on the other side they're a commercial driver. So there's an inconsistency. I can see why you'd want to tighten it up to 18 years of age. And so that part I can go with. But the idea that you're not requiring longer than 180 days, and I guess that might be addressed by Representative Feige's statement of the omission, where's the instructor? Perhaps when you consider the instructor, you might consider certification by that instructor that they would be ready for inclement conditions, Arctic conditions, wherever Alaskans with a CDL may drive.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How old do you have to be to exercise the privileges of a commercial driver's license?
Through the Chair, Representative Feige, it's 19 for intrastate commerce and 21 for interstate commerce.
19. Okay. And the follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
So the previous rule had been 2 years, and the feds are mandating 180 to comply with their rules. Is there do the feds give a reason, or are they just setting a standard time across the country?
To the chair, Representative Feige, it is a permit rule, and I don't really know the logic behind it.
Okay, but this is just simply to keep up with the federal rules. All right.
Go ahead, Amy.
Okay. Section 10. As Becky said, it allows the DMV to disqualify a commercial driver who is a permit holder in the same manner as if they had a commercial license. Section 11 is amended to comply with federal regulations, which makes operating a vehicle that's been placed out of service subject to civil penalties. Section 12 is another compliance. It adds texting to the list of serious traffic violations for which a driver could be disqualified. Section 13 defines commercial motor carrier, and Section 14 states that the effective date for the federal compliance will take effect the day after it's signed by the governor, and Section 15 that the fees related to the bill will take effect January 1st, 2015.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Gaddis.
Well, and mine isn't a question, but I would like the bill sponsor to certainly consider my texting comment to stiffen the fine, if you will. And really, I think, again, as a commercial driver, I think that you have a higher obligation not to be texting and driving. So I'm hoping that maybe you can put a little bit more teeth in the bill there.
Okay. Seeing no... Oh, Representative Feige.
Hey, just a question in Section 11. And it's, I guess it's line, the end of line 10, start of line 11. Or in violation of a railroad highway grade crossing. What does that exactly mean? And I realize it's existing law. But what does the term mean? And maybe our commercial vehicle enforcement fellow would be able to shed some light on that.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I don't know exactly what that means with the railroad crossing. I can look into it, though.
Let's see. What's that? Okay. Hey, who's the follow-up on the phone there?
Okay, does anyone on the phone know the answer to that?
Yeah. Through the chair, Joanne Olson with the Division of Motor Vehicles in Anchorage.
Yes, Joanne, go ahead.
Under railroad crossings, it is mandated that certain commercial vehicles have to stop at the railroad crossing, such as school buses, passenger vehicles, the passenger buses, like tour buses, vehicles hauling hazardous materials in transportable amounts.
Oh, yes. So if someone caught them not stopping, and, you know, just because there wasn't a train coming, so they didn't stop, they would get a ticket.
That's my understanding, correct.
Okay. Thank you. No. That makes sense, and I think that's a good I think that's a good law, actually, because it in case the crossing arm wasn't working right or something, you never know. So it's good to stop.
And then a follow-up. Right.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Section 10, that's looking at page 8, line 24. Okay, so the, I guess as I read this, okay, you lose your commercial license if you're driving after being placed out of service. And I guess what does that refer to? Is that the person driving after the person is placed out of service, or the vehicle is placed out of service?
It says vehicle.
Okay. So is that the person, the first part of that?
On page 8, Amy.
Thank you.
Line 25.
Oh, here I am.
It says driving after being placed out of service. That would be one. Operating a commercial vehicle that has been placed out of service, or operating a commercial vehicle belonging to a commercial motor carrier that's been placed out of service.
Amy, do you want to? Through the chair, Representative Feige, it's my understanding that it would apply to the driver and if the vehicle had been placed out of service, and also the carrier.
And Joanne, can you, or someone that's online,
represent Feige through the chair. Driving after being placed out of service would be on the operator of that vehicle.
Okay, and this is Daniel Smith?
Oh, yes, Dan Smith with Commercial Vehicle Enforcement, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I guess my comment is it kind of...
Follow-up?
It reads sort of unclearly. I wonder if maybe you could re... I don't know if it needs to be rewritten, but it certainly could be a little more clear, I think, exactly what you're trying to convey there.
Daniel, can you just explain in regular language what that means?
Okay. Madam Chair, a driver may be placed out of service if he is unable to operate. He may tell the officer that he is not feeling well or is incapacitated, and the officer may place the driver out of service. The vehicle may be out of service due to the mechanical condition that we find it in, or the load on that vehicle being not secured, or maybe the driver does not have qualifications to operate the vehicle. All different scenarios where we are now looking at an out-of-service condition, or after a review, the company may be out of service for a long history of violations and maybe employing drivers that were not qualified to operate their vehicles. So there are many scenarios that could lead to out of service condition that they're trying to cover all those with that sentence in line 7 or line 24.
Okay, follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on the third part of this, while operating a commercial vehicle belonging to a commercial motor carrier that has been placed out of service, how does the driver know that the motor carrier has been placed out of service? I mean, he get a phone call from somebody, hey, come on, can you do this trip for me? Shows up, does his inspection of the vehicle, everything looks good, paperwork's fine, but unbeknownst to him, the carrier has been suspended. And, you know, somebody's getting him to do this illegally without telling him. Should there be a requirement in there that he has to, you got to prove that he knows that the motor carrier has been placed out of service?
That's a good thought, and that's a thought that had been brought up to us. And if we don't have any other questions, some of the people that are online that want to testify have mm-hmm. those same questions. So,
okay.
question. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I do have a lot of questions. And before I go anywhere, I don't want to make you feel like I'm attacking you. I'm attacking this bill. And for the record, let it be known, I went online to register not only a vehicle that needed registration, but that one that was out of registration. I went online and I thought I was going to have a horrible nightmare registering one that was expired registration, and it was very simple. So thank you, Amy. I say that.
Glad
now.
To help.
Good. Okay. Now I can attack. In this bill, it seems like we're caving to federal requirements because, as it was introduced, we're going to lose federal funds. So maybe I want to ask that first. How many times, because we're constantly threatened with the loss of federal funds if we don't come into compliance with this, or with air quality, with schools, with whatever, how many times have we actually lost any federal funds by being out of compliance?
Through the Chair, Representative Isaacson, we're not aware of any. And that was a policy discussion that we had internally with our commissioner about are these regulations so onerous that we are willing to stand up and say, no, we're not doing them, and face noncompliance and face losing federal funds? And the truth is, we didn't find them so unreasonable. But we definitely had the conversation, are we willing to do it?
Well, I appreciate that. So if I may follow up a couple more times.
Follow up two more times.
Or more. So literal. If the regs, I've got the regs here, and they were proposed in October 2013, they say that they go into effect July 8, 2014, but we won't be able to go into effect until January 2015, then we will still be out of compliance, and therefore Or has that date been changed? Yeah, January 1st, 2015, Section 15. Some of it takes place immediately. Okay. So, Sections 1 and 2. Thank you, Madam Chair. I stand corrected on that one. Section, I take it that these sections are those that give the federal government the ability to act on our part. So let me ask you that question. In Sections 1 and 2, for example, page 2, it says, number 12 on line 19, the applicant is a commercial motor carrier prohibited from operating by a federal agency. So now the federal government is going to dictate intrastate, not interstate, but intrastate. They're telling us that whether or not we agree, we better stop this. And so it's kind of like going to Representative Feige. Yes. Going, Representative Feige was saying, "Well, how does one know?" And to do that, you know, the department may refuse to register a vehicle on page 1, line 6. You may refuse to register a vehicle, but does that mean that you have some leeway then on page 2? Line 19, number 12, the applicant is a commercial carrier. Does this, let me modify my original question in view of that line. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the, you have some discretion on whether or not you are going to register a vehicle, even if the federal government prohibits it from operating? I should ask
that. Through the Chair, Representative Isaacson, it says that we may.
Okay. So on Section 2, it's amended to read, again, the department may. So then on page 3, lines 24 through 27, again, the federal paternalistic heavy hand is not telling you you cannot. It's giving you discretion. So let me rephrase how I was going to ask the question. What would happen if you went ahead and went against the federal prohibition and you enabled a carrier or an operator to exercise within the state of Alaska? Would we then be in violation of federal law that would also make it $34 million of federal funds at risk?
Through the Chair, Representative Isaacson, I think I would lean on the Department of Law to answer that question.
Madam Chair, is there a Department of Law?
Kathleen Estrosbar from Ledge Legal, are you online?
I am, Madam Chairman. I'm not familiar with the, through the Chair, Representative Isaacson, I am not familiar with the particular funding scheme that's involved in each of these sections, but I believe that federal road safety rules apply where federal funding is used, and federal funding is often used for state roads as well as federal roads. So the question is, are there federal road funds at risk? And so that would be a question that whoever supervises our applications for federal funding would be in a better position to answer, but I would see that there be two components, federal interstate regulation and safety regulation for roads that are involved in interstate travel, and then another layer, the funding, the provision of funding for our roads.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. And Amy Goldsmith, do you have, she's with our Department of Law, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Amy Goldsmith with the Department of Law. My understanding of how the federal funding works is that if our statutes and regulations are out of compliance, we stand a chance to lose out on a portion of the basic program funds. So if we enact this bill, which brings us into compliance, but then don't enforce it or enforce it badly or make a few mistakes, I don't think that will jeopardize our funding. The funding would only be jeopardized if we don't pass this bill at all and continue to be out of compliance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So a couple more.
Representative?
If we're saying, going back to the commercial 10,000 pounds, I just want to make absolutely certain, because this bill uses commercial vehicle throughout, and because it it includes a vehicle 10,000 pounds or more unladen weight, are we making sure that we are not calling that commercial vehicle 10,000 pounds or more commercial?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, we are not calling that vehicle commercial. This is strictly for purposes of fees. Commercial vehicles are defined for enforcement purposes, which was the 14,000 pounds and are and up to 26,000 pounds, is my understanding.
Okay. And then just one last one for now, if I may, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So, because this goes back to the idea of this making Alaska roads safer, how many accidents have happened that we are actually protecting Alaskans from? Is there, in other words, a history of accidents that have been occurring that necessitate these changes, or does it just, well, the federal government says it makes sense, so we better do it, otherwise we might lose our money, and so let's call it safe for Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I'm not aware of any crash data.
Okay. Perhaps if you could supply that when we look at this again, that would be helpful because, again, the premise is to make Alaska roads safer, and I'm not sure necessarily how this is completely doing that.
And I don't think we'll expect that from Amy. We might have to get it from someone else, but Amy doesn't have that information. So,
yeah. Thank you very much.
Representative Gatz.
And Madam Chair, and I can understand, but does this bill really try to make Alaska law conform with the federal law so that we can stay in and allow ourselves to get the federal money? Is that really where we're going with this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I think in some ways it is about the federal funds, but it's also about strengthening the CDL programs nationwide. We want to be consistent with what the other states are asked to do or required to do.
Through the chair, I can't help myself. So this is the common core for CDL drivers so that we'll nationalize our testing. I'm just teasing in regards to that. I certainly understand where you're coming from. Thank you.
And, you know, in all of this, you know, if we go back to Section 1, the very first part, it says the department may refuse to register a vehicle if. And so it's not saying that we have to, but if we can put it in there and still get the funding, hey, you know, it doesn't say they have to. It just says they may. So, you know, it's not like we're locking into something that's absolutely impossible to do or that they're forcing us to do, but for a simple thing like that, I think it's good to do that. So. Anyway, Amy, do you have anything else to add?
I don't, Madam Chair.
All right. You know what I'm going to do? We do have someone online that's been waiting patiently, and it's Aves Thompson with the Alaska Trucking Association. Aves, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Go ahead. I know you had a few questions, and so go ahead and give, you know, introduce yourself again and give us your testimony.
I'm Aves Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association, and I have just a few short comments on this bill. Number one, as we talked about the issue of on line 19, page 2, where it talks about the applicant is a commercial motor carrier prohibited from operating by a federal agency. Federal agencies can only issue out-of-service orders for interstate carriers. They cannot issue an out-of-state order for a intrastate carry because they have no jurisdiction.
All right.
Same thing is true on page 3, line 24, where we talk about they're going to, what are we going to do here? Suspend or revoke the registration of someone where the owner or operator is a commercial motor carrier prohibited from operating by a federal agency. That the motor carrier...
Abe's, what page are you on?
Page 3.
I'm on page 3, line 24.
Got it.
Where earlier the paragraph starts out, it says the department may suspend or revoke the registration. Where the on line 24, the owner or operator is a commercial motor carrier prohibited from operating by a federal agency. The federal agency can only put an interstate carrier or an interstate driver out of service. And as you look then at line 26, number 13, there it talks about the commercial motor vehicle is subject to an out-of-service order issued by a state or federal agency. Now, that would cover the commercial motor vehicle, an intrastate commercial motor vehicle, but not an owner or a motor carrier. There's just a fine line distinction there.
Aves, and I think maybe that's one reason why it says may.
Yes.
You know, that kind of gives us that freedom there when it says may.
Correct. And then, Madam Chairman, if I might, I've on page 7 in section 9, Representative Feige referred to the an adult or a 21-year-old being present in the cab while a commercial instructional permittee is driving. Is the Trucking Association agrees 100% with that idea. On page 8, line 24, again, Representative Feige talked about or asked the question, how is the driver to know? And what we would suggest respectfully, Madam Chairman, is that on line 24, number 7 there, that the sentence start with the word knowingly driving after being placed out of service, operating a commercial vehicle that's been placed out of service, or knowingly operating a commercial vehicle belonging to a commercial motor carrier that's been placed out of service.
Okay, thank you. Amy, do you have any comments?
If I might, Madam Chairman, one more.
Okay.
On page 9, line 7, the same idea where the line begins, vehicle or who operates. I would request that you insert the word knowingly between who and operates.
Okay, thank you. Amy?
Madam Chair, I think that would be a question for the Department of Law because I don't know whether that changes it significantly or not. I would rely on the expertise of Anme Goldsmith.
Madam Chairwoman, this is Anme Goldsmith with the Department of Law.
Yes.
Whether knowingly should be inserted in those three places is something I'll have to think about and maybe talk over with the enforcement people at DOT because it's just not something that I can really give you a good answer for right now because I haven't thought about it very much. But one thing I can say is that when a vehicle is placed out of service, the officer will put a big orange sticker on the windshield. So it's pretty hard to not know if you're driving a vehicle that's been placed out of service. But I will think about the comments that Aves has made and at the next hearing, I'll have a better answer for you.
Okay. How hard, and you might not know the answer to this, but I'm just wondering how hard it is to get that off that sticker off if they want to take it off. I don't know. But anyway, thank you. We're holding this bill anyway, so if you can get us that information, we'd sure appreciate it.
Madam Chairwoman, I will do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, one other point of discussion that I've had with your staff, and that relates to the fees section on page 4. We have a motorhome listed on here as a vehicle that would be charged the fees for under 10,000 pounds, but there are some motorhomes that are actually used in commercial use, and I would suggest, as it what it is in the current statute, that it have the text behind it that says not used or maintained for the transportation of persons or property for hire or other commercial use, after the words motorhome.
Okay. I think probably what we'll do is we'll look at all these different changes that need to be taking place and just bring back a committee substitute is what we'll probably do. So we'll put that down too. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? And I'm not sure. We'll do this on Tuesday, but I think I neglected one thing. I think I neglected to open public testimony again. So it's been opened and closed. thank you. Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify? Okay, so public testimony is now closed again, and we will bring this back again on Tuesday, and hopefully it'll look better for everyone concerned. And I have to look. That's the only bill that we have on Tuesday then. Okay, so next Tuesday we'll hear again Bill 378. And we are closed for today. Thank you.